Good morning. Welcome to Shattering Myths, the program devoted to the largest segment of society, serving those who know that the world's religious, political, economic, and military institutions are corrupt, that they've become counterproductive. I am Yada. Our number, if you'd like to join us anytime over the next 2 hours, is 877-300-7645. I want to begin today, since we will conclude today, considering the measures that are being foisted on a gullible public regarding Islam and Christianity. I'd like to begin with Paul and return to the second chapter of Galatians, where Paul is confronting the disciples. The background here is that Paul had been preaching a message that was wholly and completely, totally contradictory to what Yahweh had to say and what Yahusha said. It was a message that was completely disconnected and disjoined, really the absolute inverse of Yahweh's Torah and Yahusha's testimony, as well as his life. And so Paul was claiming that he had met someone who Christians would now identify with as Jesus, even though there was no one named Jesus in the first century, on the road to Damascus. And, of course, Yahusha, the real name, says, no, that's not the case. If anybody claims to have seen me, you need to disassociate from them. Do not believe them. Do not follow them. Because he said, when I am next seen, I will be seen by everyone at the same time. But nonetheless, Paul realized that most people were unaware of what Yahusha said, that they were unaware of what he said, and that were unaware of the Torah, and that that as a result, there would be people ignorant enough to be fooled by him. And that condition persists to today. And so he began a message that was punctuated with, "But I, Paul, say." And he would try to usurp credibility, not only by claiming falsely that God had chosen him, which is interesting, of course, because God was here and he chose 12 men. Paul wasn't among them, and yet Paul was in Jerusalem at the time. Despite the fact of how ridiculous that claim is and within the context of Yahusha spending 3 years training the 12, if that wasn't a benefit, why did Yahusha bother doing it? But yet that's what Paul would have you believe, that not only was God incapable of choosing men who could communicate his message, he was incapable of training them to do so. And according to Paul, he was even incapable of devising a plan that had any chance of prevailing. And that his original plan, called the Torah, was completely and totally failed. That it could not save. That it was actually counterproductive and that it enslaved. And so he's out speaking against the covenant that's in the Torah and against its sign, circumcision. And he's calling the covenant that is memorialized in the Torah of the flesh, which resonates with Greeks because Greeks view anything that has any association with the flesh as being evil, as being corrupt. And so he has this Gnostic message of spirituality that resonates with Greeks who are already indoctrinated in the sun god religions of Babylon, paganism. And so he's preaching a god, about a god that's almost identical in virtually every way, down to the subtleties and nuances of Dionysus. And so it resonated with some of his Greek audiences, the combination of the spirit's good, the flesh is bad, anti-Semitic nature of Greeks, which is still raging today. Greeks is the single most anti-Semitic nation on earth. That the God of those terrible Jews, that God is of no account. And his testimony that he provided through those Jews, two Jews, the children of Israel, to Yehuda, was, of course, evil, counterproductive, enslaving, mean, which played, again, right into the mindset of anti-Semitic Greeks and, to an equal degree, anti-Semitic Romans. And with that message, as he would continue to say that he was chosen by the God who authored the Torah, even though he's contradicting the Torah, and that he was specifically chosen by Yahusha, even though he's never quoting him, never once, and contradicting everything he represented, the reality is that a disproportionate number of people who heard him, who were knowledgeable, rejected him forthright. And some were initially, well, I'll go and hear what the guy has to say, but they rejected him immediately thereafter. We know that because of the fact that that Paul's subsequent letters, even to the Galatians, the first community to whom he wrote, he's saying, what's the matter with you? Why did you reject what I told you? Why did you go back to that old God and that old testimony? So here's Paul besmirching the Torah, besmirching Yahweh's testimony, undermining everything that Yahusha said and did while claiming to speak in his name, and literally opposing the Torah, calling it the covenant of the Torah of the flesh, and therefore enslaving and evil, and specifically against its sign, which is circumcision. So some of the original disciples heard that he was saying this, and while they wouldn't care what he was saying on behalf of Judaism, they wouldn't care what he was saying on behalf of the Talmud, they wouldn't care what he was saying on behalf of Gnosticism or of the Roman or Greek pantheon of false gods, he was claiming to speak in the name of the God that they had come to know and love, Yahusha. And so when he was claiming to speak for him and yet spewing out a whole cadre of lies, they said, we need to have a talk. And so they summoned him to Jerusalem. It's called the Jerusalem Council, the Jerusalem Summit. And there it was Paul versus the disciples. And Paul specifically condemns Shimon Kefesh and undermines the credibility of Matanyah, Yaokanan, and Jacob, James, John, Peter, and Matthew. And while they rose up and spoke out against Paul, Paul decides that what he's going to do, since there were so few people at this meeting, that he would take the approach of spinning that meeting such that it made him appear credible while undermining the credibility of the disciples. And that's what the second chapter of Galatians is all about. And there's nothing more to it than that. It's Paul claiming that the disciples are of no account, that their testimony has no value, and that they somehow yet endorse Paul. Now, if their testimony is of no value, their endorsement of Paul would be meaningless. So we know that there is a bending of the truth in that regard. And so that's the basis of what we're going to consider now. And so Paul said, later, through 14 years, I went up to Jerusalem along with Barnabas, having taken also Titus. I went up from an unveiling revelation which lays bare. Now, that's not true. He went up based upon the fact that he was summoned. And laying down to them the beneficial messenger I preach among the races from my own uniquely and separate view. And so he's distinguishing himself, his messenger and his message, from all others, including of course, the disciples, according, from even Yahushua, according to Yahweh. This is Paul versus God, Paul versus the disciples, Paul versus everyone else. It's Paul's message versus God's message. So he's admitting right from the beginning that he went up there to preach among the races his own and separate, unique message. Then he said, but to the opinions, the presumptions and suppositions that somehow perhaps into foolishness and stupidity without purpose I might have run. So this is Paul saying that, yeah, they brought him up here. I'm going to kind of give him a slideways notice that I was brought up here and that there was an inference. It actually was an overt statement that what you're saying is counterproductive. What you're doing here, you're running in vain. You're leading people astray. And so Paul is saying, well, that was just their presumption. That was their supposition. That was their opinion that somehow into foolishness and stupidity without purpose and falsely that I had been running. Well, that tells you that that was the purpose of the meeting. Those who knew Yahushua, those who knew better, made it very clear to him that what you're doing and saying is false. It's stupid. And it is stupid. It's foolish. It has no purpose. You're running in vain. To the contrary, then, he says, not even Titus the Greek was compelled or forced, nor pressured, obligated to be circumcised. So we now know that the one of the most important differences between Paul and the disciples was circumcision. Now, the fact is that Yahushua was circumcised. The fact is that Yahushua affirmed every word of the Torah. The fact is that Yahweh says that circumcision is the sign of the covenant. He says it's the sign of the covenant for all people, for all time. It did not matter if you were a Yehudim or a Gentile. As a matter of fact, there is a specific acknowledgement regarding circumcision being the sign of the covenant, that it is for Gentiles and, which are Goyim, as well as for Yehudim. And while you do not have to be circumcised, you do have to be circumcised if you're a man and you want to be part of Yahweh's covenant family. Moreover, if you're not circumcised, you cannot attend Passover. Now, Paul is a very clever individual. He's a really lousy writer. It's really hard to translate what he has written so that it sounds lucid, because it never does. He's a very, very crude communicator. But he is a clever individual. And what he is saying here is true. In fact, virtually all of it is true. But it's only true in a way that is most people would not suspect. For example, when he talks about him being called up to Jerusalem, that's true. He was summoned to Jerusalem. When he says that it was by a revelation, well, you know, Scott, tomorrow is going to be Saturday. Did I just reveal something to you? You already knew it, but
my mind is blown.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I know. It's a profound revelation. But when you tell somebody something, you're revealing something to them. And so he did get a revelation. The disciples sent emissaries out to him and said, you know, what you're saying is false. It's counterproductive. You're misleading people. You know, if you're going to pretend that you're talking about Yahushua, we need to talk. So he did receive a revelation. It's just that he wants to infer that his revelation came from God and that it was God that had sent him up there. Well, why would God want to send him up there? I mean, the fact of the matter is that if he was doing the right thing, why would God need to send him there? I mean, if I am reading the Torah and communicating what it says, what advantage would there be for me to go to a place where there is almost no audience for the Torah? You know, if I were to go to Jerusalem, do you think that anyone's going to listen to me talk about the Torah? I mean, I'm going to have three groups of people there. I'm going to have, in fact, four groups of people. And you tell me which of these four groups of people are going to be interested in me talking about the Torah. One is the largest group are going to be atheists. Socialist secularists. Secularists. I mean hardcore, extraordinarily socialist atheists. They have no interest in hearing what God has to say. The next largest group are going to be fundamentalist religious Jews who are devoted to their Talmud and Mishnah, but do not want to hear anybody talk about the Torah, the real Torah. So no resonance there. The third largest group are Muslims. And I can't even talk in Israel about Islam because it would be a crime. Of course, there'd be no interest there. So the last group would be very devout Christians who think that they're living in the Holy Land. Not going to resonate with them either. So why would God, if so long as, you know, I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing, I'm sharing his Torah, I'm translating his Torah, I'm contemplating his Torah, I'm observing his Torah, I'm listening to what he has to say in his Torah, and I'm sharing that with others, and communicating its meaning and how it affects our lives and how his teaching is insightful and revealing within the context of our world and within human institutions. If I'm doing that, and I'm doing that, and there's an audience for that, people who are interested in hearing it, why would God ever call me to Jerusalem? Well, if Paul was doing this, why would God want him there? He already had emissaries in Jerusalem. Why have him there? Well, you know, the fact is that he was called there because what he was saying was untrue. And I want to make this point very clear. The disciples would not have cared at all that he was preaching about Dionysus and quoting him. And he was. They would not have cared at all that he was promoting Gnosticism and the superiority of the spirit over the flesh. But he was. They would not have cared that his portrayal of God was virtually identical to Dionysus, even though he did. They would not have cared about any of that stuff. You know why they wouldn't have cared about that stuff, Scott?
Not totally. Obviously because they knew the truth. They knew the truth.
They wouldn't have cared if he was a fundamentalist Pharisee preaching Judaism. Wouldn't have cared. Does God tell us to go out and bring people into our covenant who are religious?
Definitely not.
Does God tell people they can't be religious? He tells them he doesn't want them to be religious. But he tells them you can't be religious? No, you just can't be part of his family if you're religious. Now, the other thing that's interesting, of course, is that Paul is the primary user of the term euangelion. It means eu in Greek is beneficial, could be healing, and it is often translated good. And then agelos is the Hebrew, or excuse me, the Greek word for message or messenger. It's the word, of course, that is transliterated into English as angel. So, you know, if you were doing what most publishers do when they see agelos in Greek, they render it angel. This would be good angel. The good angel that I speak. The beneficial angel. And, of course, he is speaking on behalf of an angel. The Hebrew term is malach. It means messenger, envoy. And Satan and his demons are malach. And so he's speaking on behalf of a malach. There's no question about that. So the term that he's using is interesting. And he is being honest. It's his ego getting in the way, but he's saying that the message that he is preaching and the beneficial messenger that he's representing it's different than anyone else's. It's true. That's absolutely true. Well, it has commonality with Greek Gnosticism, and has commonality with the Greek son of the sun, Dionysus, but it has no commonality with Yosha. It has no commonality with the Torah, has no commonality with the disciples. So it is his, and it is unique. So what he then goes on to say, and it's also true, that the disciples were of a completely different opinion. Now, I'm not a fan of the word opinion and supposition, and because of the fact that Yahweh was really effective as a communicator. He speaks so consistently. He provides so much detail. He is so just marvelous in his way of providing testimony that there really doesn't need to be. And there are so very few things that Yahweh has to say where you would feel comfortable saying, well, I presume. This is my opinion regarding that. You might find a few things you say, you know, this is how I interpret it, but that's an analysis of the evidence, yeah, using reason. And there are people who can come to different interpretations of things along the way. But an opinion is typically unfounded. It's without evidential basis. And I don't think there's anything that's important to God where an opinion matters. Our opinion most certainly doesn't matter. And to form or hold an opinion is pretty much useless. But if you wanted to degradate someone's testimony, if you wanted to demean their testimony using ad hominem, if you did not have a credible argument to wield against them and therefore ad hominem against the individual was your only means of prevailing. So you're going to slander the credibility of the individual because you can't refute their testimony, the evidence that they bring to bear. Then what you're going to do is you're going to say, well, that's your opinion. And so that's what he's saying here. That some people held the opinion, they presumed that what he was saying was false. And they did hold that opinion. And matter of fact, they held the opinion to the degree that they knew for fact that what he was saying was false. They had made that conclusion, as have I, as has any informed and rational individual. So we're moving to this realization he's trying to demean and trying to refute the credibility of others by demeaning their character. Then he says, you know, the question was, and it's true, this was the question, at least that was posed to Paul. It's not a question, and from my point of view, although I think we ought to be questioning Paul, but the issue was that what he was saying was false, that he was running in vain, that what he was doing was counterproductive. And it's interesting, of course, that he even used the term ran, because the prophecy that Yahweh presented to us about Paul 666 years before he wrote his first letter in Habakkuk 1, 2, and 3, where Yahweh names Paul by name and says that Shaul, which is Paul's given name, was the plague of death. He talks about his running and is a definite reference to this man claiming that, you know, he is running and running. And God says, yeah, that's the charge that he's going to make at the fulcrum, at the crescendo, the highlight, at the preeminent point of his argument. And this is what he's doing now. He is saying the disciples are wrong, I am right. They claim that I was running in vain, as did God, and I'm going to refute them. And his refutation takes us to the heart of the argument, circumcision. Yahweh says, if you're not circumcised, you cannot participate in Passover. You wouldn't want to participate in Passover if you weren't circumcised, because if you're not circumcised, you can't be part of the covenant. Therefore, you can't have a relationship with God. And if you're therefore take place at Passover, you become immortal. Passover is the doorway to life. But you're estranged from God because as a man, you're not circumcised. You're therefore not part of the covenant. The only way to become immortal, separated from God, is to spend eternity in Sheol. So Yahweh says, don't participate in Passover if you're not circumcised. And it's the weird twist, of course, of Christianity. They convolute what occurred on Passover, but that's all they ever focus on, is what occurred on Passover. And that's what they want to celebrate, and yet the founder of the Christian religion was wholly and completely opposed to circumcision, which means that you could not have a worse scenario. It's the scenario where everyone who believes Paul, who pays attention to what happens on Passover, but is not circumcised, does not accept the terms and conditions of the one and only covenant, chooses to reject it and accept Paul's covenant, they become eternally separated from God. That means that they go from their soul dying to their soul spending eternity in hell. It's a very bad choice. So Paul's tells us that the argument was on circumcision, which means it was on the sign of the covenant, which means it was on whether or not the covenant still stood or was there going to be a replacement covenant, which gets right to the crux of Christianity. And then he uses a specious argument. He says that Timothy was not even compelled to be circumcised. And we've gone over this. God doesn't compel anyone. So no matter how consistent, how blunt, how bold the disciples were, or Yahweh is, or Yahusha was, regarding circumcision and the absolute requirement to be circumcised to take place in Passover and therefore to become immortal, to be part of the covenant, to engage in the covenant, or to have entry to heaven, where circumcision of the spirit and of the flesh are both required, even though God is consistent and emphatic, he does not compel it. What he says is, if you want to benefit from Pesach and have eternal life, if you want to be part of his covenant family and spend eternity with him, if you want entrance into heaven, if you're a man, you're going to be circumcised. No exceptions, because circumcision is a sign of the covenant. And if you don't have the sign of the covenant, you're not part of his family, therefore you are estranged from him. But that doesn't mean that God's compelling it. He just says, if you want these benefits, then that's the sign that you've accepted the conditions to receive those benefits. If you choose to go off and preach, that's your call. And this gets us back to the beginning, as to why the disciples would not have given two hoots about what Paul was saying, if Paul was speaking on behalf of Dionysus or behalf of Bacchus or on behalf of Zeus or on behalf of Jupiter or on behalf of the Talmud or the Mishnah or on behalf of any other document or wannabe God, they wouldn't have cared, because 99.99% of the people were aligned with those false gods. They had accepted those false gods and those false religions. And so God never tells us that we should usurp free will and prevent people from making a bad choice. All he wants is to encourage people to get to know him and make the right choice. And if you're right, make the right choice, then great. The thing that he also wants us to do is to expose and condemn those that are deceiving in his name, those who claim that they are speaking for him and yet are misleading people. So they would have had an interest in Paul only because he was claiming to speak in the name of the of Yahweh and of Yahusha. That was his claim. And if you claim that and what you're saying is false, then you show up on the radar of anyone who's part of the covenant. Then you are individual. You have become an individual that is our enemy, that is in direct opposition to God, that needs to be exposed and condemned. And therein is the reason that Paul was summoned. So Paul is saying, but hey, you know, we had this disagreement over the covenant and whether the old covenant still stood and whether its sign was productive or counterproductive and whether Greeks, you know, should be circumcised like, you know, like the Jews. And yeah, I was already answered that question. If you want to be part of the covenant, you'll be circumcised. It doesn't matter if you're Greek or Jew. If you don't want to be part of the covenant, that's just fine. Don't be. But there's no compulsion, and therefore Paul was just deceiving. His whole purpose in making that statement was to mislead, to cause people who don't know what God had to say, that don't know that Paul's animosity to circumcision here was adverse to God. Then it went on to say, but on account of the false brothers, brought in surreptitiously under false pretenses, who had sneaked into the group secretly to spy upon the freedom and liberation that we possess in Christo, in order that they will make us subversive. Now, the fact is that Yahweh is our liberator. The entire purpose of the Torah is to lead us away from religion and from politics, from oppression, from slavery. That's the story of the Exodus. It's the story of the seven invitations to meet with God. It's the purpose of the Torah. It's the purpose of the covenant. You don't go from slavery to liberation. It's interesting when you consider the fact that Yahweh tells us as it relates to his covenant. In fact, the first thing that he etched in stone was that he liberated us from slavery. Liberated us from all of the religious oppression, political oppression, economic oppression, and military oppression that was brought to bear against his children in Egypt, in the crucible. And when you consider the freedom that Adam enjoyed with Yahweh, the liberation that from the flood that Noah enjoyed with Yahweh, the ability to walk away from these very same contagions, religion and politics, that Abraham enjoyed with Yahweh and taking him to the promised land where he was free to engage in a relationship with God. And then you consider the experience of Moshe liberating the children of Israel from Egypt. The whole story is about liberation. There is no time ever that Yahweh says, I want you to be subservient to me, to anything I've had to say, to a book of rules. To be subservient means you have to obey. And what people just don't get is that Torah does not mean law. It means guidance, to guide. And there is no Hebrew word for obey. Nothing. In fact, there's no Hebrew word that's even close to obey. And so this is the basis of Pauline Christianity, is that the Torah is bad because it makes you subservient to it. And that his gospel of grace is wonderful because it liberates you from being subservient to the Torah, from having to obey the law. Oh, I'm sure that resonates with Christians, but it's just not true. It shows that you're completely ignorant of what the Torah is about. There are no more liberated individuals than those who are part of the covenant. We are the most liberated, the most freed individuals in the universe. We're freed from death. We're freed from corruption. We're freed from ignorance. We're freed from indoctrination of human institutions. We're free to spend eternity with God. We become immortal. We are liberated and empowered and enriched in every possible way. We're free from lies. So there's nothing in the Torah that would make you subservient to anyone, much less God. And yet that's his whole myth, that what he has is freedom. And what God is offering is entrapment and enslavery and obligations and laws and rules and dictates and the like. And so he's presented it. That's the case that Paul is making, that he is about freedom and that those who are trapped in the Torah are about being having to obey, being subservient. What's really interesting, of course, is that liars always contradict themselves. So when someone doesn't obey and submits to what Paul has to say, he condemns them. And it's also interesting that Paul tells his faithful in his most important letter, that to the Romans, that they need to submit to the Roman government. So they can't submit to the Torah, to God, because that would be bad. But they do need to submit to the Roman government. That would be good. Just think about how good God is, how well-intentioned God is, how beneficial a relationship with God is, and how disgusting the Roman Empire was. Vicious, enslaving, murderous. And yet Paul would tell you in Romans 13, you need to submit to your government. And he's writing about the Roman government. And yet you should not be submit to what God has to say. Now, if you're informed and rational, you're going to scream and say, there's no way that this man is telling the truth. This makes no sense. So, we have a rather serious problem. Now, Paul then goes on to say that these individuals, they faked their relationship. They were brought in under false pretenses. But none of that could be true. So, we have an imposter. Someone who had their own separate and distinct message. Someone who wanted to destroy the credibility of those that Yahweh himself had chosen and taught. It's the strategy that you would expect from Machiavelli. It's the strategy of Goebbels. It is not the strategy of God.